Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, research into addiction. Plus, people who are asexual have few sexual feelings and are happy about it. And using Buddhist-style meditation, or what's called mindfulness meditation, to treat sexual difficulties, including pain, lack of interest, or as a result of cancer treatment. The person doing this work is Dr. Laurie Brottle, who's Associate Professor of Gynecology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Well, mindfulness techniques have been in existence for millennia now, at least 3,000 to 4,000 years in the Eastern world. Since about the 1970s, mindfulness-based techniques have made their way into Western medical healthcare, primarily through the area of chronic pain treatments. Since that time, they have been applied and tested in a variety of different medical conditions and psychiatric conditions. Mindfulness can be described as present moment, non-judgmental awareness, and it's the embodying of the present moment in a non-judgmental and compassionate stance.
So give me an example.
So an example would be taking part in a 20-minute body scan that invites the individual to pay attention and notice different parts of their body progressing from, say, the big toe all the way up through the tip of their head, noticing the sensations in those parts of the body, attempting to distance yourself from any distracting thoughts or judgments about those parts of the body, and really tuning into the breath as you're moving through different parts of the body.
So accepting the world as it is.
In a nutshell, that, yeah, you could say that. It is accepting whatever it is as difficult or as painful or as emotionally vulnerable you might feel.
Let's talk then about, there's two different areas in particular you've been working on in using this technique applied to sexual problems.
Mm-hmm.
What's this vulvodynia that you've been treating, or vestibulodynia is what mm-hmm. some people call it?
Provoked vestibulodynia, or PVD for short, can be described as a sharp shooting burning pain around the opening of the vagina or the vulvar vestibule. It affects probably between 15% to 20% of women across ages.
And that's a huge percentage.
It is an enormous percentage of women when you compare it to, say, the prevalence of depression or diabetes, which have rather similar prevalence rates. Yet public awareness about PVD or vulvodynia more generally is really quite poor.
How disabling is it?
Well, women will say that it becomes increasingly more disabling with time. So with the first few attempts at intercourse, there's kind of a normal acceptance that it might be awkward, it might be uncomfortable. But when this persists for many months or many years, as the data suggests that the average woman experiences this pain for about 4 years before she receives a diagnosis, it begins to extend into many different parts of her life and her relationship. Interference can range from difficulties riding a bike, wearing certain types of clothing, to significant impairments in the relationship. So not only is sexual intercourse or sexual penetration completely avoided, women will say that they avoid all kinds of sexual intimacy, including touching and kissing or holding hands, for the fear that it might lead to this painful experience.
Give me a typical story.
A typical story will be the 21-year-old woman who says, I've never been able to use tampons, I've had numerous yeast infections and have tried a variety of treatments for this condition, and my earliest experiences of intercourse have always been really quite painful for me. I attributed the pain to the yeast infections, or I attributed the pain to my sexual naivety. Yet it was only when the pain persisted for many years that I said to myself, there must be something more going on. I went to my family doctor. My family doctor did a physical exam, couldn't find any signs of inflammation or infection or redness, and said to me, it must be all in your head. Go home and have a glass of wine.
And is there a cause?
This is an area of intense scientific research. The more that we learn about the pathophysiology of pain in general, the more we're understanding about provoked vestibulodynia. Our best guess is that it's characterized by central sensitization. So in other words, there seems to be a dysfunction in the pain centers in the brain. It's probably not a local inflammation or local infection response, although that's what the earliest research tended to focus on, something in the local periphery. And now, with the advent of imaging research and intense research in this area, it seems to be characterized as a central sensitization phenomenon.
And it always starts young?
From what we know, about half the women will describe a lifelong picture. where penetration of any kind, tampon use, gynecologic exam, sexual intercourse, has always been painful. But for about 50% of women, they'll describe more of a secondary picture, where they've had no discomfort at all with penetration, and then an event in their life or some sort of physical assault or trauma has led to the onset of these symptoms. The latter group we tend to see more often in peri- and postmenopausal women.
How are you treating it?
Currently, our center has moved almost exclusively now to mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral groups. And this is stemming from really a large body of research finding that mindfulness-based therapies can be very effective for a variety of chronic pains. So our typical format involves having a group of, say, 6 to 10 women with the condition taking part in weekly 2-hour sessions over the course of 8 weeks. The in-session component involves a combination of education, some elements of psychotherapy, and a fair bit of mindfulness practice. And in between the sessions, we give women a number of homework exercises as well as guided audio CDs to listen to.
So tell me about the mindfulness part. What do you do with them?
So the in-session practice will involve either one of the facilitators leading a guided mindfulness session or listening to an audio recording. We can use different facets of the woman's experience, whether it be taste, so you might ingest a raisin and focus on all of the different qualities of the smell and the taste as one is taking in this small piece of fruit in their mouth. We also might do a listening meditation. We may play a particular piece of music and have women in a non-judgmental, present-oriented way focus on the listening piece. Or we may do something that's a bit more focused on her body. That might be focusing on the breath, focusing on different parts of her body and, say, a body scan.
But it's not focusing on her genitalia.
There is an at-home exercise where the woman is asked to actually provoke the pain through her hands, and that then becomes the focus during the mindfulness-based exercise. So as she is provoking the pain herself, can she experience the pain sensation itself without all of the additional layers of suffering, emotional turmoil, distress, devastation that the pain tends to evoke when she's being sexual with a partner?
Like you're trying to remove all the collateral damage.
Exactly.
And what happens?
We've been running similar groups of this kind, albeit in a more abbreviated format, for about 5 years now, and the feedback has been really very positive. From not only the pain sensation decreased, and how we measure pain sensation is we will actually have women take part in a controlled Q-tip test where the physician will touch around the vulvar vestibule with a cotton swab and the woman will report how painful the experience is. So we see a decrease in those pain ratings. I think also more importantly than that, women will self-report that they're focusing on the pain less, the pain is less catastrophic, they're not as hypervigilant to the pain, they're avoiding sex less. Overall, their sexual response has improved as well.
And they're enjoying sex?
They're starting to enjoy sex as well.
How long is the treatment?
Our current protocol is an 8-session treatment, and we strongly encourage women to continue practice following the 8 weeks. In other mindfulness-based protocols that have looked at this for pain and other conditions, again, they find that those patients who do the ongoing continued practice tend to show sustained benefits even 5 years after treatment.
And the homework?
The homework involves daily mindfulness exercises of various forms. It amounts to approximately 30 minutes every day of structured practice.
Doing what?
The practice at home will involve some of the segments that we're doing in session together, as well as additional exercises that we've discussed in session but have not actually practiced in session. So, for example, having the woman provoke her own pain and be very mindful of the pain in a sort of non-judgmental, present moment kind of way.
So it's fairly intimate and not something you could do in a group.
That's right. And that's why we reserve some of those more intimate exercises for at home. There's also homework exercises of a more traditional sex therapy kind of variant. So sexual communication exercises, sexual touching exercises, sensate focus exercises with those women who are partnered.
And you've been using this technique. In fact, you're applying this, what you've learned from looking after people who've had cancer.
That's right. So in the last 7 years, we've carried out at least 3 studies now adapting the mindfulness-based intervention to gynecologic cancer survivors whom we know have a high incidence of sexual side effects following treatment. Most recently, we've looked at a 3-session or a 4-session mindfulness intervention versus a waitlist control group or an education-only control group. And women will report improvements in their level of sexual desire, their level of sexual arousal. We also measure the physiological sexual arousal response. So we have women come into our lab. We expose them to some short video clips, neutral and erotic video clips, and we measure their sexual arousal response before and after treatment. And not only do we see an increase in the genital arousal response, but we also see more agreement between the genital response and women's self-report of being sexually aroused. So it seems like their mind and their body is more in unison following the intervention.
So if you like, there's a non-disjunction here that if you show an erotic video to somebody, they get a genital response, but their brain might not register that fact. So their body's responding despite their mind.
That's right. That's a well-recognized, well-replicated finding in women's sexuality, that the genital arousal response tends to be quite automatic. Yet the subjective response, women may say that they're not aroused at all by the film, or they may even say that they're completely turned off. This really characterizes a lot of the sexual difficulties that we see, where women will say, my body is responding, but my mind is simply elsewhere. I'm focusing on other distractions. For the gynecologic cancer survivors, many of them will say that they're worried about pain, they're worried about what their partners might be thinking during sexual activity. They have a whole host of myths and maladaptive beliefs about, will sexual activity cause the cancer to recur? Can I transmit my cancer to my partner? And all of these kinds of beliefs tend to surface during sexual activity.
And you're working with men now?
Increasingly, we're working with men.
This is post-prostatectomy.
That's right. So post-prostatectomy and also men following treatment for colon cancer who will report a very high incidence of erectile difficulties, but also some of the very similar concerns that women are reporting, not feeling interested, feeling distracted, being preoccupied about how the sexual encounter will progress given a period of relative sexual abstinence during treatment. We've adapted many of the same exercises and material for women and now to men.
With good results?
It's too early to say because we haven't looked at any systematic data so far. We have anecdotal feedback from the men and it's been very overwhelmingly positive.
Now this is your observation. How much randomized controlled trial evidence have you got, the sort of gold standard for evidence?
Yeah, so most of our research has begun in the pilot data sense that we're trying to see what the elements of the treatment look like, so they've not been controlled. We have recently randomized women to the mindfulness group versus an education-only group, and so we are finding that the benefits that women are showing with the mindfulness-based intervention cannot be accounted for by simply the passage of time, nor the expectation that they might get out of participating in a research trial.
Dr. Laurie Brotto of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Laurie Brotto is also studying a fascinating group of people who are basically asexual. And her starting point was that this was a problem.
Yeah, this is a fascinating area of study because these individuals, which by our best estimates represent probably 1-2% of the population, will say, I'm not interested in sexual activity. Nothing provokes sexual desire for me, yet it doesn't bother me in any way. And the only kind of semblance of bother or distress is that it bothers people around them. So society or partners or friends might say to the asexual individual, but don't you ever get sexually excited? Isn't there anything that ever turns you on?
Or you're really gay.
Or you're gay or you're repressing something or perhaps you were the victim of trauma as a child. Our group has explored many of those different possible explanations for asexuality, and we find that this is a very psychologically healthy, well-adjusted group of individuals, and this is likely not a sexual dysfunction.
So you've been just trying to find out more about them.
Yeah, so until now our research has largely been descriptive. So through a combination of large internet-based surveys as well as inviting asexuals into the lab where we can actually measure the sexual arousal response, we've been able to learn some really interesting findings.
So when you show them erotic videos, what happens?
So they show the same genital arousal response that those individuals who say that they have sexual interest show. So the conclusion there is that it's not a dysfunction in the plumbing, so to speak. It's not a dysfunction of sexual arousal.
You see something erotic, your body responds, but they're not interested.
They're not interested. They say that they would rather be watching, you know, a boring documentary.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about them? What have you found?
So we've found that this condition is probably not a sexual dysfunction because there is no distress associated with their lack of desire. And it's caused our group to increasingly look at, well, could there be some sort of neurodevelopmental or congenital reasons that could account for the asexual orientation in the same way that there's very strong and conclusive evidence for those factors in homosexuality? So we've looked at some biomarkers, such as looking at the ratio between the second and the fourth digit. We've looked at handedness. In other words, we know that gay individuals have a much higher prevalence of left-handedness compared to right-handedness. And we've looked at something interesting called the fraternal birth order effect, which is the finding that gay men have a much higher rate of having older brothers than age-matched straight men. And we're finding some of those same kinds of correlates among asexuals, starting to point to probably more a neurodevelopmental etiology to account
for. So tell me more about this second finger, fourth finger ratio, because it's thought to be influenced by something in the womb, by the exposure to male hormones in the womb.
Yeah, so the finding is that the ratio between the second and the fourth digit significantly differs in gay men versus straight men. There's a similar finding among lesbian women versus straight women, although the differences don't tend to be as strong as you see in men.
And this is where the fourth finger is bigger than the second finger.
That's right. That's exactly right. And what we find among asexuals...
So we've got a whole audience now looking at their hand.
Well, here is where we need to pay attention to measurement issues, because there really is a science behind how you're measuring the distance between the base of the finger and the tip of the finger. And so for those viewers who are watching this, you know, put the ruler away. You really need to see someone who's actually skilled in doing these kinds of measurements. So what we found among asexuals is that the ratio between the second and the fourth digit on their dominant hand resembled the ratio among the homosexual samples that have been widely published on in the past and significantly differed from heterosexual samples.
And so they show a similar pattern to homosexuality.
Exactly, yeah.
But they're not gay.
But they're not gay. They're not attracted to men or women.
What's going on?
We really don't know. Our research and the very preliminary research of others has been purely at a descriptive level, trying to characterize these individuals. And I think what we need to see more of is more kind of basic science research, perhaps doing some imaging data on these individuals, actually looking at the brains of these individuals while they're exposed to erotic films to see if the brains are actually registering the erotic content of the stimuli.
And you show them heterosexual erotic content or homosexual erotic content?
Yeah, so until now we've only shown heterosexual erotic content, although we know that for women, the kind of erotic stimuli that you show, be it heterosexual, homosexual, or even primates having sexual activity, really is irrelevant. Women will show the same level of genital arousal response.
It's profoundly disturbing.
Disturbing or very, very interesting that the genital arousal response is so automatic and so robust.
What about the lives of these people? What's happening in their lives?
Yeah.
Are they single? Are they partnered?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, I think you see the same kind of variability among asexuals as you see among sexual individuals. You see some that will describe themselves as asexual romantic, which means that they desire the same kind of closeness and compatibility and long-term stability in a partnership that a sexual individual will, yet they have no desire for the sexual elements of that relationship. Yet you also find other subgroups of asexuals who will describe themselves as aromantic, so no desire for the sexual, and similarly no desire for any romantic attachment at all as well.
Do they marry each other?
there is a very large online asexuality community, and part of that website is devoted to matching. So it's a bit of a, you know, an online dating website for asexuals. That's an ideal situation because it allows one to overcome all of the, you know, the difficulties in having one asexual partnered with a sexual person. How do you negotiate sexual activity in those partnerships? But it does happen. It does happen that some asexuals do partner with sexual individuals.
That would be nice if they could find each other, because they could have an intimate companionship that might be actually undermined a little bit if there was an incompatibility between the two partners.
Yeah, that is ideal, although the typical story of the asexual individual is not one in which they wake up one day, you know, early in their sexual development and say, oh, I'm an asexual. The more typical story is one in which the individual doesn't have any sexual feelings, yet they engage in many years of experimentation, testing out whether they might be attracted to men or women or other variants, etc. And so their observation that they are indeed asexual tends to happen much later on in life. Many of them will say that it is only upon finding this online asexual community that that is the first time that they've identified with that label.
Never let it be said that I don't take you to interesting places. Laurie Brotto is Associate Professor of Gynecology at the University of British Columbia.